Welcome to Canary in a Cornfield, a podcast from the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, where we explore how the policies that shape our food and farming systems impact our health, our communities, and our future. As most of our listeners probably know, the Harkin Institute was founded upon the retirement of longtime public servant and Iowa legend Tom Harkin in order to continue doing high-quality work on the policy issues that were important to him. One of the most pressing issues facing agriculture today isn't just the weather or the soil, it's the market itself. Over the last few decades, we've seen a massive shift towards consolidation, leaving many independent farmers with fewer choices and less control over their own livelihoods. To help us navigate this landscape, I'm thrilled to be joined by Angela Huffman. As the co-founder of Farm Action, she has been a leading voice in the fight against agricultural monopolies. Her work focuses on holding powerful corporations accountable and advocating for policies that support competitive, fair, and sustainable markets. She also wrote a post on her Substack that caught my eye. The media paid a lot of attention recently to a letter written by leaders in the field of agriculture warning of widespread collapse of the agricultural system. And Angela wrote a really nice critique of that letter that pointed out some of the things that were true about it, but also some of the things that it missed. And so that is going to be part of the focus of our conversation today. So with that, we are going to jump in and welcome Angela Huffman. I am really excited today to be joined by Angela Huffman of Farm Action. Thank you so much for joining me today, Angela.
Thank you so much for having me, Adam. I'm excited to be here.
Before we jump in, maybe you could tell me a little bit about Farm Action. It's a group that does a lot of great work.
So Farm Action, we're a watchdog organization. We are farmers fighting for accountability from both the government and large corporations in the food and agriculture sector. So what we do is we monitor all of the sectors across agriculture. We uncover and expose wrongdoing when we find it, and we push for accountability through government policy. Importantly, we're a farmer-led organization. Most of our staff, board of directors, are farmers. We have a great network of local leader volunteers across the country, a lot of farmers and other food system advocates that really help inform our policy development and our research and helping to tell the stories of what's going on the ground. I'm a co-founder of Farm Action. My colleague Joe Maxwell and I co-founded Farm Action 6 years ago now, so we're a fairly young organization. Joe and I have been working together for 15 years, and we decided we wanted to create a group that has this lens looking all the way across the food supply chain, from the seed all the way to the consumer's plate, and really shining a light on how those sectors have been captured by corporate interests and how those interests are shaping policies that are benefiting them at the expense of everybody else. That's why we love working with unlikely allies, whether that's folks fighting for better animal welfare or for the environment or for workers' rights. We love to collaborate. We know that farmers only make up 1% of the population in the United States. And unfortunately, many of the groups in Washington, D.C. advocating on agriculture issues, they go in and claim to represent the interests of the farmers. That's not always the case. So farmers really need a lot better representation and a lot more power. And that's why we like to work with folks all across the food supply chain, consumers, because farmers alone, being such a small percentage of the United States, unfortunately, really need strong allies to work together to fight for a better food system.
Iowa is a great example of how interconnected everything is, where our rural areas are getting hollowed out and losses of jobs out in different parts of the state. And a lot of that is connected to the consolidation of the ag industry and the farm economy.
Yeah, Iowa's really ground zero for hog confinements and the water challenges resulting from that. And on the other side of that, so much great organizing. I'm just so inspired seeing all of the great organizing that goes on in Iowa fighting back.
That's true. Thank you for pointing that out. You guys have done a lot of wonderful things, and I think we'll touch on some of them, but the most recent thing that prompted me to reach out to you was you wrote a post on Substack about a letter that had been getting some attention. There was a letter that went to Congress that was warning of, I think the term was, potential collapse of the agriculture industry because of some of the current policies that are going on. And And there have been different groups and individuals who have been highlighting that letter in Iowa, but I thought you had a really important critique of what were some good elements of it and some other things that need to be considered. So I was wondering if you could talk through what you wrote in that Substack post.
Yeah, that letter was signed by former USDA and commodity group leaders. Like you said, they warned of widespread collapse in agriculture coming. And I think they're right about that. We're losing 63 farms are going out of business every single day since the last census. But their letter names a lot of the symptoms, and I agree with them on those. But I think that it misses a primary cause, and that is the consolidation of the agriculture system. And I was also concerned about these folks. They're a lot of the same people who have spent the past few decades working on policy that has gotten here. They've advocated for the get big or get out model. They've pushed farmers into growing a narrow set of commodity crops for feed, fuel, and export. And now they're asking in this letter for more of the same policies, these quick fixes that don't address that underlying cause of consolidation. So that was my main critique, and I'm happy to talk much more specifically about that.
Before we jump into the critique, could you mention some of the parts that you thought were accurate?
One thing that was interesting, these are former ag leaders. And I think the reason that it was former ag leaders who were speaking out is because their critique was pretty focused on the Trump administration's policies. And I think maybe they felt a little more safe to come out and say what they thought. And a big part of that was focused around President Trump's trade policy. And I agree with them that when President Trump came back into office and started talking about tariffs, implementing broad across-the-board tariffs again, we immediately published something outlining what strategic tariff policy could look like. And that is targeted tariffs, not across the board, not tariffs that are going to invite retaliation, not tariffs on sectors we rely on and need. This letter talks about a lot of the inputs that farmers rely on. They're calling on stopping the tariffs on those so those prices come down. I think that makes sense. But I think we've already seen from President Trump's last term when he imposed across the board tariffs. This is just deja vu because back then China retaliated and we ended up having to pass a massive bailout package just to try to save farmers who were impacted by those policies. So we already saw those policies fail, and now they've failed again. Farmers are really on the brink, and I agree that these tariffs are going to push a lot of farmers out, especially those farmers who rely on export markets, and within that, farmers who are on the smaller size, because larger farmers will have a little bit more ability to shoulder that burden. So what I'm concerned is going to happen is a lot of those smaller commodity farmers are going to go out and the larger ones will buy them up. So it's just going to drive more consolidation. So to me, the tariffs was really the large part of their focus in that letter. And I do agree. But other things they talked about were a little thin, like pass a new farm bill. Well, we do need to pass a new farm bill, but it can't be business as usual. So yeah, they were onto some good things in there for sure.
That's helpful. Thank you. I think in there they reference the importance of farmers and the fact that farmers are on the brink. And it seems like that is where your critique comes in terms of how we got to this point where there are so many smaller farmers struggling and at risk of going out of business.
Yeah. I'd love to just touch on a little bit about consolidation, because I think that's the root cause of the crisis. The trade issues, they're kind of the straw that's breaking the camel's back now. But consolidation and these structural problems with our food system is what got us here. And FarmAction has a really great data hub on our website where we look at every single sector and look at who controls those sectors, what has happened over decades in those, and what are the impacts of that consolidation for farmers and consumers too. So just to give you a high level, we found that today, just 36 corporations control nearly every industry involved in growing, processing, and distributing our food. So the whole chain. And that's because decades of weak antitrust enforcement has led to these levels of concentration. And that's by wading through merger after merger in these sectors. So they've just become more consolidated. And so what that looks like, for example, we rely on just 4 corporations to produce 80% of our corn seed. We have a beef industry where 4 corporations control 85% of the market. 4 corporations control 69% of our grocery stores and so forth. And economists say that when Four corporations control more than 40% of the marketplace. Abuses are likely to happen. So that means price fixing. That means squeezing farmers and retaliating against them when they speak out. At 40% control, they're able to really have their thumb on all of us throughout the system. And we're seeing that really in every sector now. So that's the problem. As a result, these companies are raking in record profits. Farmers and workers both are really squeezed in the system. And then consumers are seeing higher costs at the grocery store. But zooming out, I guess even more from that, kind of the structural problem with our food system or the root cause of this crisis is a policy that we've shifted into that rewards the overproduction of commodity crops and a dependence on exports. So there's three buckets of that. The corporate consolidation really began in the 80s. There was a shift in antitrust enforcement policy. This began in the Reagan administration and has continued since. And that really just started allowing all these mergers to happen. Second was in 1996, the Freedom to Farm Act, which was that year's farm bill. That's when they began to encourage farmers to plant fence row to fence row. That was a direction of Congress, encouraging farmers to overproduce whether or not the markets needed it. And then third, and this is a big one that we really focus on it, Farm Action, is our subsidy structure. So government subsidies favor a narrow set of commodity crops, and that's mostly corn and soybeans that you'll see driving across the countryside. And that really has crowded out the production of fruit, vegetables, other grains that actually feed people. So that combination has left farmers trapped on this treadmill of debt, and then taxpayers are paying the bill for that fallout through the subsidies that prop up the system and then through repeated bailouts just to help farmers survive because the system doesn't make any sense. We had three bailouts in the last year alone. That's not a fluke or it's not a bad luck. This is a real structural problem, and that's what we've really been wanting to communicate. Yes, the tariffs have been problematic, but this has been decades in the making.
And I guess one thing I wanted to highlight is consolidation. And I think there was actually a theory behind it where people might have known about some of the harms of it. But the idea was that, well, if you have this vertical integration and a smaller number of companies, that would generate some kind of efficiency. And then those prices would get passed on to consumers. But of course, that's not at all what we're seeing. And so it seems like we're getting the harms of all that consolidated power, giving them leverage against small farmers and against other people, but it's not really to the benefit of consumers. Does that sound right to you?
Exactly. And that was exactly the justification of the shift in merger enforcement in the 80s, shifting towards efficiency, and they called it the consumer welfare standard. So like you just said, it was talking about this will be more efficient and it's going to be better for consumers. It's going to mean lower prices. But the reality has actually been, one, it's not more efficient. Like we saw during COVID, for example, the breakdowns in the supply chain. These are very vulnerable supply chains, but it's not efficient if it's not even able to function. And that focus on efficiency cannot trump resiliency and actually being able to withstand those kind of shocks. So that's really a problem. And it's really not delivered better outcomes for consumers. In our food system, it looks like much lower quality food, unhealthy food, an abundance of overprocessed foods, heavily sprayed in pesticides, and health impacts of that and the costs related to the health outcomes of our food system, the environmental issues that also impact our health. And then just simply higher prices at the store. Besides those externalized costs, like onto the environment and onto our health, the actual dollars we're paying at the grocery store. I mean, this is an area Farm Action focused very heavily during the avian flu crisis the last couple of years, was on egg pricing. These companies used that excuse, which avian flu was very real, but they used that opportunity to hike their prices by much more than what would be needed to recover their losses. In fact, a couple of years into the avian flu epidemic, Cal-Maine, the largest egg producer, they had hiked their prices substantially and not reported a single case of avian flu by that point. But they see these opportunities. And one more example of that is the price fixing cases. Just about every month or so, another price fixing case gets settled in the courts, particularly in the meat sector, beef, poultry, pork. There was just one a few weeks ago, Tyson Foods settled a case, and I think it was the chicken sector. So basically what these companies are being accused of because there are so few of them and they're sharing data, they're coordinating, or at least they're accused of doing so, coordinating to set their prices and keep their prices high. Instead of competing with each other, they're working together and they're just settling case after case in these price fixing cases. So it's really not ended up with that better welfare for the consumer by any account.
And when they have that monopoly power and there's so few companies, they can just set the price point where they want. And then, as you mentioned, the companies are making billions and billions of dollars, but that doesn't get passed on to consumers or to the farmers or a lot of other groups. And you wrote another piece about the Tyson settlement, right? And how it wouldn't help any checkbooks. Could you say a little bit more about that?
That's right. Yeah. And actually, that's the case I was just referring to, that most recent settlement. Yeah, because these companies are making billions of dollars every year, and then they'll settle a price fixing lawsuit for a few million dollars or so. And that's a drop in the bucket. And I think at this point, it's just part of their business model. They're probably working into their budget. We're going to have to set aside. And we even made these little pie charts showing here's their entire net profits, X number of billion. And then there's a little slice of the pie, a few percentage of that. That's the few million dollars that they're paying in price fixing settlements. So what's the deterrent? What's going to stop them from breaking the laws if they're not going to be held accountable?
Those graphics are really powerful. You mentioned the harms of consolidation, and you talked about how the suggestions in that letter weren't really getting at the root problem. Could you say a little bit about some of the things that you think would be a step in the right direction that might help with some of the challenges of consolidation and how that's squeezing farmers?
Absolutely. And this is a great time to be talking about that because Congress is right now writing a farm bill, the 2026 farm bill. We're expected to actually see the text potentially the end of this week. They're going to start debating the farm bill the week of February 23rd. So Farm Action, we've been very focused on what are these solutions, and we've published a farm bill platform on our website that lines those out and that we're going to be advocating for. But to boil it down, farmers need a real path that is not locked into producing these commodities for feed, fuel, and export, while rural communities are struggling to afford food. So we need to get back to growing food in America. A lot of folks like to say that we're feeding the world, and we always prided ourselves on feeding the world, but that's not true anymore. In 6 out of the last 8 years, we have had an agricultural trade deficit, meaning we're importing more than we're exporting. In fact, we import 60% of our fruits, a third of our vegetables. And last year and this year, our trade deficit is going to be about $50 billion. So it's not even a little bit that we're relying on other countries to feed us now. It's a lot. So a big priority is helping farmers to start diversifying their operations. So to us, that means supporting those farmers who want to diversify and transition into growing food crops and livestock and other mixed systems that not only feeds our neighbors, but also makes farms more resilient when, say, China stops buying this product. It's just smart to diversify, and you're not relying on a single export buyer for so many of your crops. So we're talking about that, rebuilding regional and local processing and distribution, because that's really just gone by the wayside while these large companies have gobbled that up. So we're pushing for rebuilding slaughter capacity, cold storage, aggregation, distribution, all these steps in the supply chain that it takes from the farmer to get crops and livestock from the farm to the consumer. Another really important one that we're calling for is to be creating more steady demand for these products through institutions like schools and hospitals and food assistance. So the government is actually the largest purchaser of food in our country. And right now, more than half of USDA's purchasing goes to just 25 corporations every year, the same industry giants. So if they would start shifting that toward smaller farms, regional farms, looking at values like organic and regenerative and pasture-based and those kind of factors, rather than just what's the largest and easiest. A large company with a huge supply, I get it, it is a lot easier, but it doesn't support our farms. It doesn't support our health. When you think about what kids are being fed in school, we could do so much better, and it would be a win-win for our farms.
Well, just to jump in there, I should have said earlier, even though you talked about the tariff policy, I think Farm Action is a group that is very nonpartisan, where you'll work with Democrats when it makes sense, you'll work with Republicans when it makes sense. And one of the things that I noticed was that Farm Action spoke positively about the new nutrition guidelines. And so I just had a guest on who was, I think, a little bit more critical, but it was a nuanced perspective. But it seems like what you're talking about in terms of the government being the biggest purchaser of food, the USDA guidelines, individual people don't really look at that before they decide what to eat, but it could make a big difference for purchasing. So do you see opportunity if the government purchasing is aligned with some of the nutrition recommendations?
That's exactly what we're looking at. And I think we definitely don't get into nutrition. We're not nutritionists. So just to be really clear about our take on the guidelines, that's just not our expertise. We're not able to judge, was this good, what they did on saturated fats or this or that. So where we saw positive though here was around the focus on whole foods, real foods. And I love that simple message, but where the rubber meets the road is on whether then the government shifts policies to be in line with those guidelines. Because if not, like you said, I don't think the average person is really using that to plan their meals necessarily. And really the purpose is to inform and influence this kind of purchasing that I was talking about. So I think for them to do the right next step would be to start putting that into their procurement policies. And something that unfortunately the guidelines, not just this set of guidelines, but no guidelines have ever taken into account how the food's produced. And that is another critique that we had, because for health, that really matters. It matters a lot how it's produced. Just for example, we know that food produced in low quality soil that's been stripped of life in the soil produces less nutrient dense crops. There are studies on that. Whereas regenerative, organic, healthy soil produces healthy food, and it makes sense. But that's just an example where that's not addressed in the guidelines, but we would really love to see federal procurement start to prioritize those kind of values too. But real whole foods is a good start. And that's where we see an opportunity to say, okay, let's help you align your purchasing with these dietary guidelines that you just put out.
That makes sense. And it seems like there's a little bit of conflicted messaging in the current administration and different factions of the MAHA movement, where on the one hand, there's talk about whole food and real food, which is great. But then other dimensions, there's not as much attention paid to not every hamburger is created equal. And maybe some of that should not be considered quote unquote real food in the same way that pasture raised beef is. So anyways, I'm glad you guys are working on that. And I know that you would steer it in a positive direction. So I hope that goes well. Was there anything else you wanted to say about the Farm Bill?
We do have a set of our top 7 Farm Bill priorities on our website. I won't go through every single one of those, but it's 7 that could be achievable and could be part of the conversation, because this is not a typical farm bill. Usually in a farm bill, a big part of that is funding decisions. But a lot of those in this case were made last summer during budget reconciliation, also known as the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. So a lot of what would normally be done in a farm bill, especially around subsidies, has been taken care of and is not expected to be part of the conversation. This is more about the rules and the rules that decide who comes out winners and losers. So it's really important. Those are the kinds of things we're looking at. But there was one that I'd love to talk a little bit about, and that is California's Proposition 12 and efforts to override that law and other laws which are set in the states by voters who want to set a higher standard for how food is produced in their state. California did that in the case of how farm animals are raised, and that has created a critical market opportunity for farmers raising their livestock that way. A lot of it's about how hogs are raised, and a lot of farmers in our network, to include my colleague Joe, who I mentioned, he's a hog farmer himself and is selling into California now that California has said we want crate-free pork. So this went into effect in 2024. Many farmers already were compliant. Others have changed their operations and made investments to become compliant and are accessing that market. And Congress, working on behalf of large pork processing corporations like Smithfield Foods, is trying to override and take away the right of states to be able to do that. So that's a huge issue that I want to flag, that is the top of our radar. A lot of the things in the Farm Bill we're working for proactively are positive, but this is a big one that we are fighting against. And it's the number one priority of House Ag Chairman Glenn Thompson.
Thank you for bringing that up. And we had an episode about that earlier. And then also Senator Harkin wrote an op-ed for the Des Moines Register where he agreed with your position. And I appreciate the approach that you're taking because the industry likes to frame it as Prop 12 is some major burden for farmers specifically, but it's really, as you said, the corporations that seem to be pushing for it, and they're the ones who are skimming the money off the top, and whatever additional profits can be made by cramming pigs closer together, those profits go to the people on top, not to the farmers. Anyways, what I wanted to say is what I think you guys have done really well is you've shown farmers pushing back against this idea of overturning Prop 12, and you had an event in D.C., was it last year?
Yeah, that event was led by the Responsible Meat Coalition. Farm Action was a part of that. About 200 or so farmers came in from all across the country, meeting with offices on the Hill. There was a huge press conference and rally. There was a tractorcade around the Capitol. It really made a splash and got attention. At the same time, we put up billboards all around Washington, D.C., in the Reagan Airport in Union Station. We had a mobile truck driving around the Capitol for days on end with pictures of farmers saying, thank you for supporting Prop 12 and upholding Prop 12, a positive message thanking those members of Congress who are pushing back. And we have been able to make a real impact with that because this issue has now become a poison pill for trying to pass the Farm Bill. If it's in there, it's really going to be a challenge to get a Farm Bill done. And even Senator Bozeman, the head of the Senate Ag Committee, he has come out and said he would rather not see that in there. And that's huge. So I think we're seeing more and more bipartisan momentum to say, what about these farmers who rely on this market? Are we really going to just take that away from them? So I'm really hopeful that we're going to shut it down this time and hopefully for good.
As you were talking about, I was thinking, it seems so strange because it seems like the classic conservative position is states' rights and the federal government shouldn't be intervening. So this issue is so strange that at least some people, not all, but some groups that are more conservative are advocating for the federal government to come in and overturn the will of California voters.
Yeah, that's very ironic. And I've been excited to see folks, Republicans like Sid Miller, the Texas Ag Commissioner, he has come out and said, hey, I don't necessarily agree with what California did, but that was their right. And I want to stand up for California's right to do what they want in their state because we want to be able to do what we want in Texas. So I agree. Yeah, it's such a conservative value, states' rights, and it's just gone out the door for some of these folks. And I think it tells you where their priorities really are and who they're being influenced by, because it's not about sticking to their traditional values for some folks.
Yeah, interesting. Somewhat related, big topic in Iowa has been some of these pesticide immunity bills. And is that something that's still being looked at for the federal farm bill?
It is. So actually, that's the other top priority, unfortunately, of Chairman Thompson on the House Ag Committee. Those are his two. And it's very similar, right? Because it's preempting the states and it's putting in provisions to provide immunity to pesticide companies. So they're basically looking to give legal immunity when people are harmed. Farmers, farm workers, even consumers who are harmed by pesticides, they want to take away people's right to justice when that happens. So that's going to be part of the Farm Bill conversation. The Supreme Court accepted Bayer's request to take up the case, and they could wipe out the ability of folks in the states to be able to bring cases. And then we're seeing legislation in the states as well. So they're on three fronts. They're in state legislatures, federal, in the Congress, and then now at the Supreme Court.
Sounds like they're pushing a full court press on that. I was curious, in line with that, the openness that Farm Action has with working with different groups and across the aisle and being willing to praise the Trump administration when they do positive things. Curious what your thoughts are on Trump's critique of meat packers. And I think he suggested that they need to be investigated for price fixing. So yeah, what are your thoughts on that? And how are you optimistic about that going forward?
So we thanked President Trump and the Trump administration for calling out possible price fixing in the beef industry, for directing the Department of Justice to open an investigation. So that's great. However, President Trump actually did this back in May of 2020, the same thing. And here we are 6 years later. And actually, that 2020 investigation was quietly closed several weeks before this new one was started. So this investigation after investigation, it sounds good. Oh, they're going to look into this, but what's going to be the outcome? That's where we're really watching to see what happens here, because the track record is not good. They were not held accountable during the last Trump administration. I hope that this time will be different, but what it's going to take is some real enforcement action against these companies that's a meaningful deterrent, not these small fines. And I would just say, too, for more context, I mentioned price gouging in the egg industry that FarmAction really was focused on during avian flu. We brought that to the attention of the Department of Justice, and they opened an investigation just about exactly 1 year ago. And I don't know where that is now, but I think that's another example where it's really exciting when officials say they're opening an investigation into a sector, but what happens after that is so much more important. So we're in wait and see mode still on the egg investigation that's a year old, and then this new one in the beef industry. I just hope it'll be more than words.
That makes sense. And some of the stuff is so entrenched that it might take someone who has that disrupting mentality to actually shake things up. It remains to be seen whether that actually happens in this particular case and some other particular cases, but I'm glad you guys are out there keeping an eye on things. Could you tell listeners a little bit more about the kind of information that you guys put out? One great thing about FarmAction is you're putting out really good information on your Substack and on the website pretty regularly. So how can people follow FarmAction, and what could they expect if they sign up?
Absolutely. Thank you for that. If you go to our website, farmaction.us, we have a sign up there at the top of the page. And that is a bi-weekly newsletter. So that comes out every other Friday. And every week we're breaking down what's happening in the news and what it really means. We have action alerts. We have really just everything you need to know about what happened over the last 2 weeks in consolidation and monopoly power in agriculture. We're breaking that down and telling you what you need to know. We aim to make things really digestible and easy to understand and easy to take action on. So I would encourage anyone with an interest in these issues to sign up on our website for that. I also, as you mentioned, I have a Substack myself that's just under Angela Huffman. And I'm putting out a piece about every week or every other week, just a little more in my own lens, but the same issues, same kinds of issues, like responding to these ag leaders that we've been talking about their letter. So when I see something like that, that I think just doesn't really tell the whole story, I'm trying to weigh in with FarmAction's lens on what the truth really is.
I appreciate that so much. And we cover a lot of different issues on the podcast, and I'm convinced that consolidation is at the heart of a lot of the problems that we're facing. And FarmAction and your Substack are essential reading if you want to know what's happening in the battle for and against consolidation. So thank you for that. And thank you so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed the conversation. And as I said, you offered a really important perspective on this recent letter that's been highlighted in different newspapers or by different politicians, and all the work that you do is really valuable. So thank you.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks so much for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
That's it for this week's episode of Canary in a Cornfield. Just a reminder, you can find the Harkin Institute on social media, which includes X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and find our webpage at harkininstitute@drake.edu. And this podcast is also hosted by Substack Canary in a Cornfield, which will include some additional links and resources that go beyond just what's in the episode. So thank you all for tuning in, and I will be talking with you soon.